This is a podcast that seeks justice. Justice for the lives stolen by those in society that hide amongst us every day. Hidden in our towns, cities, and countrysides, the places that we work, and sometimes in our very own homes. This is Hidden Killers.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for joining us. Be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss any of our conversations on the cases that we are following for you. You can get a complete list in the episode description on this episode. Today, we're talking with Lara Yeretsian about the Koberger case. We're going to dive into some of the pieces that have been kind of dripping out over the last couple of weeks and questions that have come up with those pieces. Koberger's attorney have responded to the state of Idaho's requested discovery from the defendant. Attorney was quoted as saying the defendant does not have books, papers, documents, photographs, or copies or portions thereof in the possession of the defendant at this time, which will be submitted at the time of trial. Of course, Koberger's attorneys also submitted that they are currently in no physical or mental examination, scientific tests, or witnesses that will be called by the defense to disclose at this time either. Obviously, the defense retains the right to question all of the state's witnesses and evidence and can still produce their own in the future. It's fairly typical of discovery for these sort of things to be going on, but this is a very high-profile case with a lot of somewhat bizarre twists and turns thus far. Lara, can you give us some insight into this discovery process and what is going on here with some of these statements?
These seem to be the typical requests that you would get from a prosecutor and a lot of times also from defense counsel. This is the discovery process where the two sides are exchanging the evidence or information or anything that's going to be used at trial. Now, the difference is this. The prosecution has the burden of proof. Mm-hmm. And they have a burden to turn over, obviously, anything that they plan on using during the trial, because the burden of proof is on the prosecution. They're the ones who are initially, right, presenting their case, making sure they're making their case. And every single item that they're going to present as evidence, whether it be a document, photograph, paper, statements, forensic evidence, including the names of the individuals who would be testifying as to these items, those would have to be disclosed in advance, way in advance of trial. And additionally, they have an obligation under the U.S. Supreme Court rules and case law that they would have to turn over any exonerating evidence. It's not just about giving the other side what you're going to use at trial, but they also have an obligation, a duty, and it's a constitutional thing. It's constitutionally protected right that they of the defendant where they have to turn over anything that can help the defense, whether it be impeachment evidence or exonerating evidence that tends to prove that this individual is not guilty. And if they don't, the case could be dismissed. So the heavier burden is on the prosecution. Now, the defense also has a burden to provide any discoverable material. But a lot of times the defense really, you know, they don't have to turn over incriminating stuff because they're not going to use any evidence.
Sure.
Trial. The defense is always defending, right?
Sure.
So they're not going to be using any incriminating evidence. So even if they've got it, they don't have to turn that stuff over. Usually what the defense will have, and most defense attorneys do have for trial, is impeachment evidence. And impeachment evidence is not something you need to turn over to the other side, not until the time comes where you use it, right? For example, because you don't know if you're going to use it or not. So once you've got reason to believe that you're going to use it, then at that point, maybe you use it, or as after the witness testifies and you see, okay, they made a statement, they said something that's contradictory, you can come back with your impeachment evidence. So usually the defense, this doesn't surprise me at all, mm-hmm. usually the defense is not turning over stuff to the other side because their obligations are not the same.
Sure.
And a lot of it falls under impeachment.
So if they were to turn over anything to the other side, it would be some sort of proof that he wasn't there, or if they had that sort of material or that would exonerate him, if it existed.
You mean like alibi witnesses, yeah. Yeah. Or cell site information,
sure.
Or photographs, or anything that could show. I mean, listen, they're probably in their investigative phase. It's probably too early for them to turn any of that and anything at this point. It's way too early. I think the first step for the defense is going to be to really conduct their own investigation, right? Mm-hmm. And also question and go through and analyze everything that the prosecution is turning over. And as that continues, more, they may be requesting more information or evidence or discovery from the prosecution. So it's really way too early for the defense to be turning anything over, because the defense's case, remember, depends on the prosecution case in a lot of ways, right? Depends on what their evidence is. So again, none of this surprises me. It's way too early for anything to be turned over by the defense.
Attorney for the stabbing victim, Kaylee Gonzalez's family, they filed an appeal to the Lata County judge's gag order regarding the case against the suspected killer, Brian Koberger. What does this mean? Can you speak to the importance of this and what it actually means for the integrity of the case? Is this a smart move for the Gonzalez family to say, we want to be able to talk, or should this gag order stay in place?
Well, this is a notorious case, as we all know. I mean, we're speaking about it, and hence it tells you that there's a lot of interest in this case. And I think the judge has done the right thing by putting in place a gag order. He's defending and protecting the sanctity of the proceedings. I mean, let's hypothetically put ourselves in a position where, or in a scenario where, the judge lifts the gag order, and the family members of the victims go out and start talking to the media, and you've got all these potential jurors, right, who come from the same pool, start listening to their accounts and the emotional aspects, and get information that maybe if they're jurors at a trial, they would not be seeing or hearing, right? Because someone will file an in limine motion and ensure that that's never brought into trial, or that's never introduced at trial. So it taints a jury pool. And it's already a notorious case. The notoriety of this case is on a very high level. And the last thing you want to do is make it worse. And I understand that the attorneys of the victims want to speak, but I understand where they're coming from and where the families are coming from. But at the same time, we, in this country, a defendant has a constitutional right to a fair trial and an unbiased jury. And if that ability, their First Amendment right to speak about what's happening, the attorneys of the victims, is in any way going to hinder that constitutional right, or impact it negatively, then it shouldn't happen. It's a very simple, I mean, it's a balancing act, obviously, for a court. But in this case, I think the court's done the right thing.
When it comes to making this trial go as smoothly as possible and not create grounds for a valid appeal or for some way that this could go off kilter, let's speak to Ann Taylor, the attorney that's been assigned to Koberger, and the potential conflict of interest. This is a woman who has now represented several of the parents of the victims on different occasions. One even allegedly has power of attorney over one of them. Is this, it's been argued back and forth that it is a conflict of interest, that it isn't a conflict of interest. At this point, is this something where Ann Taylor should be stepping down, even if on the books, maybe it's not, but visually and just in public, this does appear to be a conflict of interest and would give Koberger grounds on an appeal?
I mean, it's an interesting way of putting it. And yes, you do have this appearance of a conflict, right? Mm-hmm. But is every conflict a reason for someone to recuse themselves from a case? There's ways of waiving conflicts. And if you think about it, in this particular case, her clients happen to be parents of the victims, and her some of the representation was in the past, right? Mm-hmm. And there was one that I thought was current, and she withdrew as counsel because of this. It seems to be a small town, and I've gotten the sense that there aren't too many people who have the experience she has, and there was a reason why she was given this case, and she did the right thing, at least initially, by withdrawing as counsel for one of the parents. And as I said, some of the others were in the past, and it's not none of the victims were her clients. That sure would have been a clear conflict, right? Mm-hmm. So this is one step removed, but you know, you worry and you wonder what her relationship was like with these individuals. Mm-hmm. And is that going to compromise her advocacy for Koberger? And in some ways, maybe only she can answer that question. She clearly did what she had to do as counsel. And yes, there's that appearance, maybe appearance of conflict. But at the same time, I think, and I don't have all the facts, right? I don't have everything in front of me.
Sure.
That's something that she could have internally with her colleagues figured out if there's any reason, any cause for her not to be able to represent Koberger to the best of her abilities and be the best advocate for him. And to me, it looks fine. Is the appearance of conflict enough? No, there has to be a true conflict, a real conflict. And if there isn't one, then there isn't one. If there were other attorneys, I would say, you know what, maybe mm-hmm. it almost doesn't matter. Let's not take the chance, right?
Yeah.
Let's have her. But if there aren't, and he's going to get an attorney who's not experienced or is not capable of handling a case of this magnitude, then it would be another disservice to him, right? You want someone who really knows what they're doing.
Sure.
And they can be the best advocate for you. And again, it's not an easy answer because the appearance of conflict is kind of there because these are people who are, it's a emotionally charged mm-hmm. case. The entire nation is watching it. You've got families that have been destroyed, not one, but four. Mm-hmm. And you've got the attorney representing the defendant having had connections to some of the parents. But again, it's a small town, so it seems to be expected.
Sure.
And I think she could do a great job despite that.
And I believe she could. My concern would be the optics of it, of, you know, they go to trial and he is found guilty.
If he's found guilty, you know that and I know that. Whoever's yeah. going to be yeah. doing the appeal might come back and yeah. rip. This as one of the issues on appeal.
Exactly.
That's exactly where you're going with
it. Why not just knock it out of being a possibility right now? Because it actually could work to Koberger's favor. If I were Koberger, I'd say, yeah, let's keep Ann Taylor. If she's good, just in case, this is a good argument on the way out for a retrial.
He's got nothing to lose.
Exactly. Larry Uretsky, and thank you for your insight into this case. Always very insightful and valuable. That's what we got for you in this post. I'm Tony Bruschi. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any of our breaking updates and discussions on the cases that we are following for you right here. Until next time, for all of us, thanks for listening.